President Trump visited Indianapolis yesterday to push for a tax plan that he promised would simplify the tax code and benefit American families.
Our framework includes our explicit commitment that tax reform will protect low-income and middle-income households, not the wealthy and well-connected. They can call me all they want. It's not going to help. I'm doing the right thing, and it's not good for me, believe me. But what is good for me, not only as president and legacy, what is good for me is if everything takes off like a rocket ship, like it should have for 20 years. That's good for me. That's good for everyone.
Among the changes being proposed are an expanded child credit for families, eliminating itemized deductions, and ending the estate tax.
And Vice President Mike Pence is in Wisconsin today to push the message further with government and business leaders. Critics have said the plan would ultimately benefit the nation's top earners and not low and middle income families.
Vanessa Williamson joins us now. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution and the author of the book Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Vanessa, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, I'm glad to be here.
Well, Vanessa, what did you make of this rollout yesterday?
Well, you know, I have to admit, in some ways it was very unsurprising. The sort of focus on things like the estate tax and rolling back the AMT, sort of things that benefit high earners, were really expected, I think, by people who had watched the development of the various Republican plans. But the thing that really struck me is that there wasn't, you know, like the Bush tax plans had a sort of very obvious, even if quite small, benefit that was clearly going to accrue to lower income people. So on the one hand, you know, this was what we were all expecting in the tax policy world. But on the other hand, I was a little taken aback.
And the president, we heard in the speech saying that this was a tax plan changes that would benefit middle income earners, lower income earners. What do you think about that statement he put out there?
Well, I think if you look at the numbers, that just isn't really in line with the policies that were proposed. On the one hand, for instance, the bottom tax rate is actually going up from 10 to 12%. On the other hand, they're going to double the standard deduction. There's some talk about maybe increasing the child tax credit, but they didn't say how much, right? So the best economists who have looked at this vague early plan suggest that it'll work out differently for different people in the middle of the income spectrum, and it'll do very little for lower income people. At the top of the income spectrum is a lot clearer. That part of the policies were much more precisely laid out. Things like rolling back the estate tax, which affects couples who make $11 million in assets. Things like rolling back the AMT, which only affects high earners. The various corporate tax changes. These things are undoubtedly going to substantially reduce the tax responsibilities of high earners.
In terms of simplifying the tax code, do you see that here?
Well, you know, there's actual tax reform that would involve real simplification, and then there's, I think, what we saw here, which is mostly just tax cuts. There are sort of gestures at simplification that involve, for instance, reducing the number of tax rates. But we all know that it's not the tax rates, the percentages that are especially complicated. It's all the loopholes and deductions and things like that. And, you know, there's some gesture there to closing some things. I think, you know, a lot of those decisions will shake out in Congress. I think we'll probably see less of those changes than they've been talking about in the past. More generally, I think that most observers think that real tax reform is extremely unlikely, real simplification is extremely unlikely, because if you watch the healthcare debate, for instance, it wasn't obvious that the leadership in Washington had the capacity to do complex legislation where there are winners and losers and actually get bills passed, right? So tax reform is complicated in many of the same ways that healthcare reform would be complicated. And so I think they're going to have a really big challenge.
And Vanessa, are there parts of these that will be pretty uncontroversial that should have no trouble gathering support from at least Republicans in Congress? Or is it all pretty up for grabs right now?
I think most of it is up for grabs. I mean, it would be amazing to me if the Republicans couldn't get together around tax cuts. That really should be a pretty central part of the party platform and therefore something relatively simple to agree on. But, you know, I'd have said the same thing 6 months ago about appealing the Affordable Care Act, and that clearly wasn't true. So I think there are tensions within the party that are going to be difficult to overcome. There are provisions that I expected, frankly, to see more of, things like increasing the child tax credit that get huge amounts of support. But, you know, those were really not very carefully laid out. They claimed a substantial increase in the child tax credit, but they didn't say how much. So it didn't seem like that was really where the energy was. Now, of course, on the Republican side, things like rolling back the estate tax are real huge priorities. So I think on things like that, you'll really see the party come together, things that might appeal to a broader audience than sort of Republican legislators. It's a lot less obvious.
We'll get into this a little bit later as well, but I want to ask you, how do Americans feel about taxes based on your research, and how might they, based on what you've seen, respond to the Republican tax overhaul plan?
So, you know, my book is called Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes, and it's a title intended to provoke your attention because, you know, one of the things I've found in surveys and in interviews and in looking at people vote on tax issues, Americans don't hate taxes. What they hate is either the idea that someone else isn't paying their fair share, and particularly they hate the idea that wealthy people and corporations aren't paying their fair share, or they're concerned about where that money is going. Right, they would like it to go for things like roads and schools and hospitals, and they do not want it to go to, say, corporate tax breaks. So, you know, there's this myth, I think, that people are unwilling to pay taxes in this country. That's absolutely not the case. They are willing to pay taxes. They're just very concerned that other people chip in and that it go to things that are actual public goods.
Vanessa Williamson is our guest right now, and she's with us to talk about the new tax plan being proposed by President Trump and congressional Republicans. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution.
And you can join the conversation now by calling 800-642-1234. What do you think of the new tax plan, what you've seen of it so far? What do you think of taxes in America currently? What do you think needs to change, if anything? What are you hoping for? What are you worried about as Congress tackles this issue? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can leave your comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
We're continuing our conversation about the new tax plan being proposed by the president and top Republicans. Vanessa Williamson is with us now. She's a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution.
You can call in at 800-642-1234 to share your thoughts and ask your questions. Do you think we need to reform our tax system to overhaul it as Republicans want to do? Do you feel, as our guest says, many Americans do, proud to pay taxes? And what are you hoping for from Republicans in Congress? What are you worried about? Call in now at 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page.
And we'll take our first caller now. We have Pam in Oconto with us. Pam, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask?
Well, basically, I just kind of wanted to make a comment. Mm-hmm. I mean, I feel that they think that we're stupid, that this tax proposal that they're trying to put through to us, that's not going to help the average or the low income person. This is going to help the rich. You know, it always seems that they're always doing things that work to make the rich richer and basically have two classes, the poor and the richest.
Pam, thanks a lot for the comment there. And Vanessa, we heard the president in the clip in the beginning saying this is not going to benefit me, assuming he means there is a wealthy American. Who's right?
Well, I think your caller is certainly more right than the president on that front. We don't know very much about Donald Trump's taxes, of course, because he hasn't released his tax returns, which is something that presidential candidates have traditionally done for many decades, and presidents have traditionally done. But we do have the president's 2005 tax return, and it is quite clear from that return that the AMT, the alternative minimum tax, is the reason he paid any substantial amount of income taxes at all. And the AMT is one of the aspects of the tax code that his plan aims to get rid of. So the idea, and, you know, I mean, and similarly, rolling back the estate tax, you know, benefits wealthy families like the Trump family. That's just a fact. So, I mean, I think your caller is exactly right to express those concerns. And I think, you know, she was also right to express concerns about the ways in which tax policy can be really misrepresented by politicians. And, you know, there's some very robust political science that suggests that because, you know, tax policy is complicated and Americans are busy with their lives and their families and their jobs, they don't always have time to assess the policies put in front of them. And unfortunately, that means that politicians have a lot of leeway when it comes to making claims that are maybe not backed up by facts when it comes to tax policy.
Well, what do you think needs to happen as this goes forward as a proposed policy so that it can be thoroughly digested and the implications can be studied and understood and the people can weigh in? What do you suggest? What are you looking for?
Well, one thing that I would like to see, and I admit that this is probably pretty naive, is that tax policy move forward very differently from the way healthcare reform did, right? Legislation that was put forward, I mean, ended up failing, but was put forward to very fundamentally change a very fundamental part of our economy, and legislation that affected healthcare for millions of Americans, didn't go through what used to be the standard procedure, where you get a score from the Congressional Budget Office when organizations like Brookings, and, you know, organizations on both sides of the political spectrum, we try and, you know, hit it down the center, but Center for American Progress or Heritage or all the other think tanks have a time to actually examine what's in the proposals and actually have time to educate lawmakers about what's in the proposals. This year, I think we've often seen legislation coming to a vote that lawmakers themselves could not explain, and that's very worrying, right? So, I mean, if the people who are voting don't know what's in the legislation, I don't understand how you could possibly imagine people with other jobs to get that information, you know, thoroughly digested. So I would like to see the procedure work differently. I think that's, frankly, quite unlikely, but that would be a first step. More generally, in terms of helping people get better information about taxation, you know, we have to file our taxes once a year, and I think that a lot more could be done to provide taxpayers with information about where that money's going and about how the federal income tax fits in with all the other taxes people pay. You know, for most Americans, the federal income tax is not their most expensive tax. It's things like sales taxes, property taxes, payroll taxes, and those just get forgotten a lot in these discussions. So I think that there's a lot to be done to improve public education and even just the level of information that decision makers in D.C. have about the legislation they're about to consider.
Take a real quick call here from Dennis in Two Rivers. Dennis, hi.
Hi. This is confusing because supposedly rich people and corporations pay very little, if anything, in tax. But yet, if these tax cuts go through, then they'll be paying less tax? I mean, it can't be both ways. Either they pay very little and, I mean, I don't know, which is it? They either pay very little now or they would be paying even less. I don't know.
All right, Dennis, thank you for that. I'm going to jump in because we're getting short of time. Vanessa, how do you answer, Dennis?
I think that's a great question. And the answer is that our tax system, the federal income tax, is a progressive tax. The rates go up, and wealthy people do, in fact, pay higher percentages than lower-income people, even taking account of things like loopholes. We have one of the most progressive tax systems in the world. So wealthy people do pay a higher percentage, but that percentage has been declining, right? It is nothing like it was in the 1950s. It's nothing like it was in the 70s. It's not nearly as high as it was under Reagan. So the top rates are high, but they are lower than they used to be. And then, of course, there's people who earn money primarily from having a job, and they pay especially high tax rates, and people who have money from investments, and they pay much less. Similarly with corporations, there are many companies that pay quite a lot in taxes, and then there are multinational corporations that hold billions offshore, right? So there's real diversity in how much people at the top are paying, and what we're seeing in this tax proposal is a really substantial tax cut for those people at the top.
Vanessa, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Vanessa Williamson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, also the author of the book Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. She joined us today to unpack the latest tax plan that President Trump introduced yesterday.
Coming up, we talked to Wisconsin author Michael Perry, and you can support these conversations with a pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Our next guest knows a thing or two about getting work done, from his time as a volunteer firefighter to his current gigs as a writer, newspaper columnist, musician, and the host of 10 Show Radio. Michael Perry just might be one of the hardest working guys in Wisconsin. And the theme of work, it figures prominently in his new collection of essays pulled from his 15-year writing career and covering such diverse topics as mushing, nursing, and puking.
Michael Perry is the author of Population 495 and Truck, a Love Story, among many others. His new book is Danger, Man Working, Writing from the Heart, the Gut, and the Poison Ivy Patch. Michael, thanks for joining us today.
Hey, great to be here.
Now, writers have a lot of metaphors for how they do their work. You've got one that I've never come across before involving some shovel time. Can you talk about what shoveling manure has to do with your writing process?
Yeah, I've said, I think the first time I invoked this was way back when I wrote the book Population 485, but I've recently revisited it with this collection that I've just had come out because it's truly a collection of freelance work. But I've always said, people ask me, well, how does a farm kid with no writing background from rural Wisconsin make it as a writer? And I said, the only thing I know about surviving as a freelance writer is I learned everything I needed to know from cleaning my dad's calf pens, which is you just keep shoveling until you got a pile so big someone has to notice. And over time, I've tuned it a little bit. Like, obviously, I employed deployed a pitchfork more than a shovel, but I say I know an apt metaphor when I accidentally stick it with a pitchfork. But yeah, pretty much that's it. Just keep shoveling.
You know, though, I think part of why people in Wisconsin like you is they might hear that and think, well, why shouldn't a young guy from rural Wisconsin become a writer? Like, it seems like we've specialized writing to something that you go to New York to do.
Yeah, that brings to mind so many thoughts. I don't know if I can keep track of them all, but in the first place, yes, we recently did a stage adaptation of Population 485, and I talk in there about my friend Barry Lynn, the dancer, who lives in rural Rusk County, Wisconsin. Well, it's not like there really is only rural Rusk County, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, but I talk about him having a dance studio out there and doing beautiful things, and I said, you know, the only reason you would think that that's unusual is if you think art belongs somewhere else, and I think art belongs wherever it happens. Also, it does set up a tricky thing, too. I'm not at all anti the Academy. Some of my most meaningful and helpful and essential mentors have MFAs and teach at universities. It's just that idea that you don't have to be from one particular place, that you can be a roughneck and still appreciate beauty. And I think, you know, the country itself is a reflection of the damage that happens when we decide we have to just be one thing or the other. I have a book coming out in November, and I write about taking my daughters to the Shakespeare Festival on Wednesday and to the Demolition Derby on Friday, and we had a great time at both places.
You know, it seems like there's almost a movement here, because when you think about musicians in Eau Claire, and I've talked to some from Janesville who say, you know, they're motivated by farmscapes and landscapes in Wisconsin. We've talked to Max Garland, the former poet laureate in the state, who really finds a lot of his inspiration in the nature and, again, agricultural land of Wisconsin. And then there's you. I mean, we got a thing here, don't we?
We do, although I'm careful with that, too, because I grew up on a dairy farm in rural Wisconsin, so red barns, green fields, black and white cows, that's my Wisconsin. But in traveling around the state, it's always healthy for me to be reminded that Milwaukee is also every bit Wisconsin. I forget often, because I'm a flatland farm boy, that we have a great maritime history and character. So where I absolutely agree that you do draw from your surroundings, and Wisconsin is a rich place to do that. I just always want to be careful that I'm remembering all the different dimensions of it. But yeah, there's something, and I do think, I feel like I'm qualifying everything, but maybe that's because I do qualify
a careful
everything.
Writer.
There's plenty of folks who are very sure of themselves in the world, and I ain't one of them. But I do think that there's a certain amount of that, just no one else is going to do it for you out here, so you might as well do it yourself. And I think there's a little bit of bootstraps happening, although bootstraps itself always comes with a lot of assumption. But yeah, I think about in Eau Claire, you know, I when I go to Eau Claire, I always say I can walk into the coffee shop, or I can walk into the joint, a bar downtown, and if I need someone to hang drywall, there they are. If I need someone to master an album, there they are.
And you and work inspires a lot of the essays in this new book. It's not just about work, but that's been a big part of your life. Writer and rancher and nurse and musician and a lot of different stuff. What kind of perspective have all these jobs given you over time?
I'd say two things off the top of the head. One is just a deep gratitude that I've found something that I love to do. The first thing I want to do when I get up in the morning is write, and I can't believe I'm allowed to do that. And I never forget that it's a supreme privilege. On the other hand, I just have that healthy dose of knowing that it's just work. You're going to work. The book Man Working, I mean, the reason I called it that is, or it's actually called Danger Man
right.
Working, because there's a lot of humor about my own incompetencies in there. But, you know, I got a call one day from an editor, and he said, can you climb Mount Rainier? And I just said, yes. I didn't know if I could climb Mount Rainier, but that's the only answer. And then I wound up climbing with two veterans who had been horribly injured in the Iraq War. And that story is not about me. The story is about them. If you read the story, you don't even know I'm there. But that's a case of where it's not about me being all artful. It's about showing up. And now we've kind of circled back to just cleaning those calf pens. My brother's a logger. He goes out and logs. He doesn't get any awards. No one claps for him. He just gets up, and that's what he does. And so it's that fine line. I don't want to sound too corn-bone, but the truth is I am lucky to do what I do, and I do just approach it with a blue-collar sensibility.
Talking to Michael Perry, his latest book is Danger Man Working. And you mentioned, you have a sense of your own limitations. And as you go back over these essays, you have little notes about them where this last line I was kind of embarrassed by. What is it like to have a kind of a this is your life in writing over the last 15 years as you put this together?
Pros and cons. It can be pretty bracing. I mean, part of it is, for instance, when I reread that piece about climbing Mount Rainier with those soldiers, sometimes my greatest privilege, it certainly isn't in telling my story, it's in being trusted to tell the story of someone else. And again, as a farm kid from rural Chippewa County, I just can't believe that I got to do something like that. On the flip side, you're right, there are parts in there, there are some lines where I'm not even trying to be funny here, there are some lines I wrote that I'm not very proud of. And I could have changed them, I could have excised them, but I thought, you know what, I'm going to leave them and own up to them and say, you know, the news here is that perhaps we can change over time, and I hope for the better. It seems like we all hit a stage where we either dig our heels in and fight every change coming down the pike, or we open ourselves up to the idea that new things are coming and they'll be okay too. And so some of the stuff, yeah, it makes you cringe a little bit, but I think in the name of honesty, you leave it there. But all in all, I just, yeah, going through a collection like that, which has got everything in there from, you know, a letter I wrote posthumously to Lightnin' Hopkins about my daughter, to very straightforward pieces that I wrote for Men's Health. The main thing is it just reinforces to me that, for me, writing has been a means to an adventure, and I feel like a guy who got on the wrong bus, but it's a great bus.
Well, speaking of not cringing, it was a little hard. You have a piece on puking. A very up close and kind of only Michael Perry could have written a piece on vomiting. How'd you get there?
Well, that comes to paying the rent. I was had done some work with Men's Health magazine, and then I can't remember if I got sick or somewhere along the line. I also, you know, people throw up a lot when I do a lot of volunteer firefighting EMT stuff, mm-hmm. or have over the years, and still do make a handful of calls a year. And puke is kind of a universal response to a lot of things. And so somewhere in there I thought, well, I'd like to really learn about what makes us puke and how does that work. And so I got the assignment, and you're right, really went in depth on perhaps more than people want. But, you know, someone's got to do puke research.
Well, and, you know, when we see the TV shows, we see the first responders of various sorts. They're often featured, and they're the heroes. And you're right, you know, there's a lot of this being an EMT and other first responder jobs, not all that glamorous.
No, I'd say the bulk of it. You just show up. You try to help people. And sometimes it's as simple as holding somebody's hand. Sometimes it's as simple as helping them find their nitroglycerin. And then there are those times when it is a complete throwdown and you're opening airways and you're stopping bleeding and you're doing all those things you were taught to do, and you're doing them under duress and in very difficult circumstances. And but yeah, a lot of the times you're just showing up and doing the basics.
Looking ahead, Michael, generally every time I talk to you, I get the sense this guy's busy. What do you have coming up now?
I have a book coming out in November that I'm pretty nervous about. It's a book called Montaigne in Barn Boots. And it's about me reading the philosopher Montaigne and I would say reflecting on my thoughts about him, but I'm not really, more like rebounding and slam dunking and chewing over and trying to figure out Montaigne. And it's got me a little nervous just because I'm in over my head, but then that's the whole point of the book. And B, I go into some areas that I've not gone before. On the other hand, there's plenty of essays in there about me feeding my chickens too.
Should the rest of us pick up a Montaigne? We'll preview the book a little bit. Is it worth confronting, even if we feel like we're in over our heads?
Oh, sure, yeah. Montaigne was great. I mean, for one thing, it is generally agreed, not universally, but generally agreed that he invented the essay form, and I wouldn't be able to make a living if he hadn't invented that, so I'm pretty grateful to him. But the thing I love about Montaigne is, you know, we kind of started this conversation talking about this false divide between high and low culture, or you're just a regular person or you're an intellectual. Well, Montaigne was a privileged nobleman of his time, but he also wrote essays about everything from the Greek gods and philosophy to how your thumb works and the danger of riding horses in the wrong way. And he wrote about sex and life and everything in between. And so, he's very approachable no matter your background.
Michael, always good to talk to you. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. We'll talk to you down the road.
Michael Perry is a writer, newspaper columnist, musician, and host of Tent Show Radio and author of Population 485. His new book is Danger Man Working, Writing from the Heart, the Gut, and the Poison Ivy Patch.